Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. Candidates for governor have filed their paperwork. Who will end up on the ballot? And legislative leaders say there's some chance of another surplus deal. Plus, President Donald Trump is visiting Wisconsin to talk about farmers. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for June 5th. I'm Anya Van Wagtendonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Welcome to Rewind. Welcome back. Huge week this week, so we have lots to get through. Obviously, the filing deadline for candidates for this November was on Monday, and so lots that emerged from that, but we're going to really focus on the governor's race. There are 10 candidates, kind of, and you will get into many of the caveats of like what this means, but 10 that have kind of emerged. Seven Democrats who have so far successfully kind of gotten past the threshold. And then the big question is Kirk Bangstad. He declared a couple of weeks ago, said that he submitted 2,200 signatures. More or less immediately, the Elections Commission came back and said that more than a quarter of them were not valid for various reasons. The signers didn't include their addresses. Multiple pages, I think 40 pages, didn't have the right election date on them. And so he has until Sunday to cure that. But that's kind of the big question is what's going to happen there.
So let's just kind of lay the process out. So you have a deadline to turn nomination papers. The commission staff then do a review. The commission staff, as I'm stressing staff, is not the end-all be-all, like final word about who's on the ballot. But they do a review and say, okay, we're checking these things facially. Say, okay, you've got this, you've got that, you don't have this. They'll circle problems. So the problems were, for example, on your nomination paper, you're supposed to say what date you circulated it. Well, that date should match the dates of the signatures. If you write you circulated April 6th, which is outside of the window, again, April 15th, that's a problem. You can try and fix it through rehabilitation, which those are due on Sunday. In the meantime, you can also file challenge nomination papers. Those were due Thursday at 5 p.m. None were filed to Kirk Bangstad's, despite multiple problems. So people have told me maybe they're so screwed up they don't think they need to file one because the commission won't put them on. Then fast forward Tuesday. This is when the commission itself, the commissioners, make the decision who's on the ballot. So nobody's on the ballot just yet. Even if you turn in 4,000 signatures, you're not on just yet. The commissioners don't have to take the commission agency staff recommendations. They can make their own conclusions. So there'll be a memo drawn up. Hopefully by Monday afternoon we'll see it to save us late night reading on Monday about what these issues are and what they're recommending. The commission then votes. Now here's what it gets really interesting. It's split 3-3 between Republicans and Democrats. You have to vote at least 4-2 to put somebody on the ballot. So if you're Kirk Bangstad, right, the Democrats don't want him on the ballot. He is a circus, a sideshow. They don't want him to distract from this debate. Republicans, though, wouldn't mind having Kirk on the ballot because he is a sideshow. What happens if the commissioners deadlock 3-3 on Kirk's nomination papers?
Well, the Wisconsin Elections Commission deadlocking? That's never happened before.
Then he's not on the ballot. So then you have to go to court and get file a lawsuit, get a surgery to put you on, everything else. So, and that's way far in advance, but would Kirk want to spend the money for a lawyer to do this and file a lawsuit? So something to watch, but there are multiple problems. He's got to try and fix them. He actually put a post on Facebook Thursday night saying, hey, I can't find these 9 circulators. Can you guys help me track them down? Not something you usually see in a campaign. But they can file affidavits and say, yes, I misspelled, wrote April 6th. I meant May 6th on my nomination paper. It should be okay. So we'll see what that memo says on Monday, what they say about Kirk and the affidavits, but that's after you're back in the hopper to be on the ballot.
That's right. Again, the caveats that nobody's quite there yet. Then two Republicans, obviously Tom Tiffany and Andy Mansky, are in the hopper as well. But then, you know, Lieutenant Governor, Secretary of State, Treasurer, all of these offices, the state legislature, Congress. And so you mentioned the challenge route. Lots of challenges this time around, especially around these legislative races. You counted 19, mm-hmm. which I think is among
more
the largest.
I remember in a long time. Now, a couple of those 19 apply to the same race, so we're like 17-ish races affected. Two I want to mention. One, Sylvia Ortiz-Velez, remember, Democrat from Milwaukee. She's a Democrat in name but not in caucus. She left the caucus because she had this falling out above all this stuff with Hispanic Heritage Month, and then her colleagues said she threatened to shoot them, essentially, which she said was a poor choice of words, but wasn't real. That whole long story. The Assembly Democratic Campaign Committee's executive director has filed a challenge for nomination papers. There's a little bit of Dem drama there, right? Two, Russell Goodwin, who's a freshman lawmaker from Milwaukee, his primary opponent has filed a challenge to his nomination papers. Now, I talked to Russell, who told me this is all about Ryan Clancy, who is a member of the Democratic Caucus, but also a Democratic Socialist. He's been recruiting candidates to run in various races. He told me that he had nothing to do with the challenge of Russell's papers, but yes, he's backing the primary opponent of Russell because Russell voted for the transgender athletes bill that Republicans put forward. Russell also broke with the caucus, most of the caucus, and voted for the surplus package. So Clancy called Russell a Republican and Democrat is close. So it should be a fun day on Tuesday to watch this go down and the debate about who should be in the ballot come November.
Yeah, if I had to predict, I would say a lot of our show next week is going to be focused on what comes out of that meeting on Tuesday. And to kind of go a little bit granular onto one of the gubernatorial candidates, Representative Francesca Hung of Madison, obviously a leading contender in the Democratic race. She had a story that came out this week, which is that she had been sued over credit card debts, about $30,000 worth of debts unpaid to Capital One Bank. They took her to court, and according to her campaign, she has paid those debts. She put out a video where she essentially said, "I am not ashamed of having accrued debt over the course of trying to build my business." She owned Morris Ramen here in Madison until 2024, and then essentially tied it into her politics. She's also a member of the Socialist Caucus, to say that this is what working people kind of face. And so how big of a deal do you think something like this is for her specifically, given where she is kind of in the race on that far left wing of things?
In making my calls this week, my impression was with the voters she's targeting in the primary, it's probably not a big deal because they feel the same economic pressures that she says she went through with this. But with the electorate at large, probably not great. And the bigger issue might be when she said in some podcast type thing that she envisions a world without prisons. Now, that may be a wonderful thing to aspire to, but that does not play well in November electorate. Right? Can you imagine the ads they're going to run if she's the nominee, Republicans would, about pick your violent offender X, Y, and Z. She wants this person on the street, not behind bars. Now, Hong's point was that aspirationally, she'd rather invest in local governments, in mental health services, all the things that would avoid the things that lead people to crime sometimes. The pushback I heard this week a little bit was Jeffrey Dahmer didn't commit his crimes because he was socially or economically depressed, right? There was other stuff going on. For Hong, though, this is the first real scrutiny we've seen of her campaign. It's a sign she's really a top contender for the primary. And you have to look at the nomination papers. They are not the end-all, be-all. But when you turn in 4,000, which is the maximum the commission will look at, it tells me you have an infrastructure. You have an actual campaign. We have volunteers who are coordinated, are going out and getting signatures. They're enthusiastic about your campaign. They want to get you on the ballot. They're there for you. Now, it's a big jump from 4,000 to the number you'll need to win the primary, but it's an early test of it, of organization. And some others, you kind of go, well, you turned in 2,300 Mandela Barnes. That's okay, but like, are you really trying that hard to show like how organized you are? So Hong is really fascinating. I don't know that she's the front runner, as Republicans want to make her out to be. Definitely a front runner, and definitely has a path to nomination, especially with seven people, maybe eight, whatever happens to Kirk, in the field. The question is for the non kind of like Hong Mandela Barnes wing of the primary, how do you get there? Sarah Rodriguez, Missy Hughes, David Crowley, Joel Brennan, you know, Kelly Roy's obviously running too. She's kind of more on that progressive wing too, but my point is Missy, Joel, David, and Sarah all will tell you there's a path to win the nomination. That path gets better if one of the other three drops out. But why would they drop out right now? They've all got kind of the same starting point. It's worth noting, though, there's a group out there running ads for Rodriguez up to about $600,000 on TV, digital, and cable, I think, so far. The one back in Crowley is about $115,000. The ceremony is good, but is that all there is? Because she touted like $4+ million in backing in a memo back in the fall. If this is all there is, that's not going to happen. But if this is the down payment, maybe you're going to see seven figures spent on her between now and August 11th, that would help her a great deal.
Right, so maybe that's sort of a slow and steady approach as opposed to somebody like Hung, who has a great deal of enthusiasm around her from her supporters and also a great deal of enthusiasm from the people who don't support her, right? I am not getting sort of angry Republican press releases about things that Joel Brennan is saying, but I get quite a lot of those about Fran, and so coming from sort of both sides, something to watch for sure. We are also kind of starting to hear rumblings that maybe there is a chance that another surplus deal could come to the table. Again, I feel like this is the week of a million caveats. Devin LeMahieu came out and said that he is ready to bring that exact deal, the one that already failed, back to the floor if two senators will, quote, get behind the 80% of Wisconsinites who support this compromise. Patrick Teston is pushing for another vote. What are you hearing kind of behind the scenes?
If Tony Evers wants to whip votes, and if Devin LeMahieu wants to whip votes, then maybe. But I don't get the impression Devin LeMahieu is going to whip votes, or that Evers knows a path to whip them among Senate Democrats, or that the bridge is even open. So what I mean by that is the governor, we've talked before, is not a creature of the legislature. He is a guy who came with education establishment. He has not shown a deft touch in lobbying lawmakers on either side of the aisle to go his direction, other than being the governor and using the bully pulpit. So he beats up the Republicans. They're wrong. The polls show that I'm right. They should vote the way I want them to vote. It hasn't worked very well. With the budget last year, he did engage Senate Democrats because they knew they didn't have the Republican votes to pass a budget by themselves. Senate Dems got some things they wanted. Budget passed. The governor didn't engage Senate Democrats ahead of this being put on the floor of the Senate. Well, to the last minute, really. But did engage him early in the negotiation process. None of them voted for it. So is he going to go, like, roll up his sleeves, get his staff involved, call all 15? What do you need? Can I change anything? If he whips votes that way, maybe. Devin LeMahieu has three members who voted no in the Senate as well. Is he going to go call Steve Noss and say, hey, do you want some changes? Or Rob Hutton or Chris Capia? I asked Capia's office if Devin had reached out. The response I got was basically, this is like beating a dead horse. So I don't think Cap's going to flip his vote. So, but yeah, look, these guys try to keep hope alive. Also, I heard from the Republicans saying, Senate Republicans, why give Democrats a lifeline politically when they can use it against Jeff Smith in the 31st Senate District this fall and say, hey, Jeff voted against giving you money. Like, Jeff's a bad person for doing that. Or Robin Vining in the open 5th Senate District, she voted against in the Assembly. Hey, those are campaign ads. So there's also people like Van Wongard who said flat out after it failed, I am not coming back. So I'm having flashbacks to Dumb and Dumber when I was in college. When I see that movie? So you say there might be a chance. It's that level of chance right now that they're going to get this thing done, I think, before they get fought. Barring Evers or LeMahieu whipping votes.
I won't read too much into the title of that movie. As we are recording, Donald Trump is on his way to Wisconsin. People watching this may have already seen that event, but we're previewing it as of Friday morning. So he's heading to Chippewa County. He is coming to talk about farms and farming. But this is sort of in the context of some really significantly low poll numbers, his overall approval at 38%, even lower for how he's handling the economy, how he's handling inflation and the cost of living. And there is some split now among Republicans in their support for him. Still very sort of diehard support from the MAGA crowd, but increasingly Republicans who aren't ride or die for him in the same way are starting to pull away from him a little bit. So what do you make of this visit and what it means for Derek Von Orden, for Tom Tiffany, for the Republicans who have really aligned themselves with Trump up until this point?
They need him, but they also need to keep him at arm's length sometimes. So first part is, look, Derek Van Orden underperformed Trump in 2024, the only GOP incumbent in the House delegation to do that. He needs every MAGA supporter he can to turn out in November. Looking at the environment, those guys are unhappy about gas prices, diesel, a war in Iran. Okay, is it a war? Is it not? Is it over? I'm not sure. But these things that are promised to happen are not happening. Prices going down, not just not going up as much, but going down. That's not happening. Now, gas did drop below $4 a gallon this week in Madison, so maybe it's on a better trajectory for them. So you need the MAGA folks, but the swing voters aren't real happy. So how do you navigate that? That's a challenge. But if you get them motivated enough, maybe it helps. So we also have no choice. Donald Trump is the Republican Party. You look at his record in primaries, he is driving the train. You need him to get his supporters enthusiastic. Tom Tiffany needs his congressional district in the third turnout for him this fall. They need Donald Trump. But will Donald Trump be a weight on them come November with these other voters that the amount of win over.
You know, I've covered enough Trump events to know that just because he says the theme of a visit is about XYZ, let's say farmers, or he might not necessarily stay super on topic, but I'm also really interested in that message specifically to farms and to agricultural parts of the state, because that was obviously a huge part of his base in 2024. We are seeing also declining numbers among farmers. And so what is he going to do in order to kind of shore up their support, not just for him and his agenda, but also for candidates in the area, whether they stay home or continue to come out in force for Republicans. So that'll be really interesting to pay attention to. A couple of things out of the Supreme Court this week. There was a hearing yesterday. They took testimony about the possibility of changing recusal rules. I feel like we've talked about this forever because obviously there have just been significant, these huge dollar figures around Supreme Court campaigns. I was reading into the history of this. I did not realize that 2007, 2008 was seen as like this astronomical period of court spending. And of course, the last couple of years have just blown that out of the water. And so they're kind of talking about, again, caveat, talking about considering studying whether they should change these recusal rules. Let's take a look at some of the testimony that took place yesterday.
The petition is described as something, you know, quote unquote, toughening recusal. So who are you thinking should recuse that isn't recusing, and under what circumstances? For example, SEIU, they spent, according to public records, $140,000 campaigning against me. I sat on the case. They gave $400,000 plus to the Chief Justice. She sat on the case. Is that problematic? Neither of us seem to think it was under those circumstances. Who should have recused when, under what circumstances? What problem are we actually trying to resolve?
The problem we are trying to resolve, in part, is the public perception that that the court can be for sale. It isn't a universal perception, but it is a broad-based perception, and part of the problem is there is very little discussion by this court when they choose not to recuse.
So end result, they voted 5-2 to send this to a committee to study later. But what were sort of the arguments? What do you think could come from this?
Well, we have recusal rules now, and nobody's recusing really, so how's this going to change? And then two, there's an interesting argument that if you're trying to target campaign donations, are you chilling the free speech of the legal community who might go before the Supreme Court? That's a good question. And two, how do you navigate the whole like ad thing? So there's express advocacy, vote for, vote against, oppose, support, those magic words. Then there's issue advocacy. So if I do an issue ad about a justice, which is really about the campaign, but not using the magic words, do I get caught up in this rule? It's really going to be kind of a challenge to figure out something. But yeah, look, this year's race wasn't that expensive. Still blew the 08 race away. $115 million. 2025, 65, and 2023, like when the stakes are high, like there's money there. That's unlike anything we've seen before. And yes, when people go for the court, they go, am I getting a fair shake? Because they vote in a block quite often. Is that because of the influences or because of ideological preferences? You know, that's up to them to say, but it's definitely a factor in the perspective of the court, view of the court, that they are. The hot dollar race is not very partisan anymore. The jerseys are on, not just the black robe anymore, the Supreme Court.
Yeah, one of the arguments I thought was really interesting, you know, obviously we pay attention when there's an Elon Musk or a J.B. Pritzker or a Uline or, you know, one of these kind of huge donor figures that come forward, but they also talked yesterday about just simply attorneys who get involved in these cases and where they would kind of fall in line there. And that's one of these kind of wonky details that I think not everyone knows, which is that it's really only a handful of attorneys who kind of go up before the court again and again. And so what does that mean for their influence? So just one of these kind of nerdy, wonky things that could have significant repercussions. Also, last week, shortly after Scott and I taped, actually not that shortly after, it was a bit of a Friday afternoon news dump, there was a decision in this redistricting case, not about redistricting, but that the Supreme Court is going to hear the non-competitive gerrymander case that the three-judge panel said that they did not have the authority to take up. Really kind of scathing decision, or I should say a dissent from Justice Rebecca Bradley. An astonishingly activist court will once again revisit precedent it doesn't like in order to do the bidding of its political masters. Justice Rebecca Dallet then filed a concurrence just to address that directly and say, we're just taking up the case. We are not prejudging it in any way. But so what should we expect?
So they're not going to decide the maps with this appeal. What they're going to do, they're being asked to do, is the people who are challenging the maps want them to send this case back to the three-judge panel and actually have an actual trial. So remember, this is all about 2011 law Republicans authored that would set up this process that if there's a challenge to a map, the Supreme Court shall appoint a three-judge panel. That panel shall hear the whole thing, and then it goes up to the Supreme Court on appeal. The issue is that the Supreme Court, under the old conservative majority in 2022, basically said you can't have a partisan gerrymandering claim sorted out in state courts, which reflects the stance of the U.S. Supreme Court. There was a new sheriff in town, and so they're hoping, the ones challenging, the U.S. State Supreme Court, now a 4-3 liberal majority, it's going to be 5-2, will say, actually, you can talk about competitiveness and partisan gerrymandering in a challenge of a map, and so it's okay, three-judge panel, to take testimony, have a trial, reach a conclusion, and send it back to us. Well, there'll be appeal, we assume. Then it'll come back to us, then we'll have final say. The bottom line is this. There's going to be a new map in Wisconsin one of two ways in the next 2 years. People tell me, or bet. One, Dems win a trifecta, Assembly, Senate, Governor's Office, there'll be a new map, because you can redraw a map if you haven't had one authored by the legislature mid-decade. I know it'll be like the end of that decade, but the map in place was court-drawn. Ergo, there's a chance to draw one. Two, whether it's this case, a new lawsuit, at some point there will be a vehicle for the state Supreme Court. People argue that they will draw a new map, whether it's because it's anti-competitive, because of part, there'll be one. That's the prediction. Now, again, people hate to predict what courts will do, but there's this vibe going on, legal circles, of there'll be a new map somehow in Wisconsin after 2026.
Yeah, certainly not this November, we should yes. say. But down the road. Kind of quickly, there was also a really significant environmental settlement. From what I understand, it is the largest settlement that the state has ever argued for entirely itself. Wisconsin Department of Justice sued Tyco Fire Products in Marinette County over PFAS contamination, and they came to a $10 million settlement. There are a couple different pieces to it. Tyco has to invest $10 million into Wisconsin's PFAS Trust Fund. They have to provide clean water to residents facing PFAS pollution of private wells for 20 years. Sampling shows that 236 of 776, so like a third of wells tested by this company in that area, have PFAS levels above state health advisory levels. They have to establish cleanup goals and work to restore the environment in that area, and they have to continue monitoring and reporting on groundwater and surface water quality in the area. So an environmental settlement, but obviously with huge political implications.
Yeah, and interesting, both the governor and Josh Call were touting this thing. Call obviously is running for election this fall. The governor is not. So for Call, it's something to kind of tout the environmental community. Hey, he's still working on these things.
Yeah. So that'll be interesting to kind of see also how it is implemented. And then it's been, you know, obviously the trust fund. There was quite a lot of work to get to the place of building that trust fund. And so to see also the Republican responses from folks in the affected communities. The different side trying to claim credit, I think, is always really interesting. That brings us to the stock report. And rising this week, in a literal sense, is UW tuition.
So going to go up 2%. So fourth year in a row that they've voted to raise tuition after a decade-long freeze. So there'll be a surprise or politics that factor in this a little bit. And part of it is the governor's race. So Tom Tiffany came out and said that he opposed this, that if he's elected, he'll try and freeze tuition. Now, if you are with the university, you're going to say, hey, we went through a decade-long freeze. We weren't able to convince you guys, lawmakers, give us lots of money to compensate for that freeze. We are behind. We've got all these things that are going on. We were forced to raise tuition because of the neglect in their minds for a decade. Republicans will tell you they were kind of happy that it was under the Evers watch that the freeze went away because their hands were clean. Basically, they knew you couldn't freeze it forever. But they didn't want to be the ones who lifted it until, like, Evers said, okay, we'll take it away, but now it's the Evers regents who are raising the tuition. For Tiffany, you're making a pitch to younger voters of, I will try and help you. I don't want to, like, say that no young voters like Republicans right now or anything, but you can look at polls, and even though they went for Trump a little bit in 24, they're not there for Trump in 26. If you're a Republican, you need a pitch, and this fits in the affordability pitch from Tom Tiffany of, you know, utility prices are too high, taxes are too high, 400-year property tax increases coming off because of Evers, and now you got a college affordability one. It's a decent message for them. how do Democrats message this thing? Be interesting. What's their response going to be about tuition going forward? But people will tell you that during the freeze, parents liked it because it saved them money on tuitions for their kids in the UW system.
And very fair. Yeah. Next this week is Harry Waite. This is one of these election integrity activists who requested absentee ballots on behalf of Robin Voss and the mayor of Racine, Corey Mason, and he was convicted of felony election fraud and was sentenced this week. He faced up to, I believe, 7 years in prison. What did he get?
Got probation. Not bad for a felon. Now, look, Harry Waite's part of this crowd that has raised a number of claims, to put it nicely, about the 2020 election that maybe aren't true or based in reality. But there's this kind of almost cult of celebrity around him that he's fighting the good fight against election fraud. And there is, you know, an issue with my vote that you can go request his ballots. Now, the commission will tell you there are checks that if he had sent these ballots in, if he had filled them out, sent them in, they would have found them. Okay, you know, I don't know how reassuring that is for some people, but they say they're checks. He got convicted of this felony. He kind of went to the judge and was like, you got to be nice to me or not. Like, he wasn't really very conciliatory. He said he would do it again in a heartbeat. I think he told others, don't do it because I got like 130 grand in legal bills. Otherwise, showed no remorse whatsoever. Now, I have not been convicted of a felony in my lifetime. If I am, I might show remorse and be nice to the judge before I am sentenced. He went the other direction and got 3 years probation. And talked to some people in the legal community. Look, he's a nonviolent offender, first-time offense. This was a political act in nature, which he says he's a whistleblower, so that all factored into what came out of it. He's also going to appeal the entire thing. But this was not a great deterrent for those who might try something similar going forward.
Yeah, one phrase that he used that stood out to me at some point in his legal troubles was that what he did was criminal but not nefarious. So it was sort of an act of civil disobedience. And falling this week is Randy Brace, the Iron Stash.
So he raised $8.6 million in 2018, that cycle run for the 1st Congressional District. He couldn't find 1,000 signatures on the ballot in 2026. Raised the question, was he actually running a campaign this entire time? Now, he had made noise about running, announced in May of 2025. He had raised less than $45,000 by the March. So people are kind of like, what's this guy doing, period. After the final pass on Monday, didn't turn nomination papers, he said in a Facebook post, like, he wasn't going to run, he had some family issues, told us in a phone interview that he couldn't be 150% committed to running, had some family stuff going on, didn't say what it was exactly. It did feel like there was a campaign period that he was putting together. If you go back and look at what happened post-2018, he created this iron pack, which is going to help blue-collar, working-class congressional candidates, you know, do good things. The first 3 months he had it, half the money he raised was paid to him for consulting fees and covered his travel costs. So there's a feeling he was trying to kind of, you know, get a little something back from the effort. When this one wasn't panning out, people kind of went, what's he doing? Well, again, the answer was nothing. Like, basically, I won't be flippant about it, but he didn't have a campaign. He wasn't actually running for Congress. He was on social media a little bit, and this is what we get. So now he's out. You got four Democrats left. One, Mitchell Berman, put out a memo last week saying, I raised $500,000. I'm a real threat to Brian Steil come November. You've got Alderman Burgess from Milwaukee, who lives outside the district, which seems problematic when you're trying to connect to voters in Beloit and Janesville. My bottom line is I don't get the impression that Brian Steil is staying awake at night worrying about the four guys left running, or even with Iron Stash in there, Randy Brace. He's got a lot of money. Yes, challenging environment right now. If gas is $4.50 a gallon come October, it'd be bad for Republicans in general. But Steil, again, $5.6 million. He runs above the top of the ticket most of the time. He's not somebody abrasive like a Varick Van Orden, who's always being targeted in the 3rd Congressional. He's kind of, you know, nice, comes across, nice guy, isn't out there saying really off-the-wall things. He's pretty straight-laced kind of guy. So he's the favorite. If things completely fall apart for Republicans, maybe. But I'm not getting the vibe from my conversations, I don't know if you are, that Mitchell Berman, Burgess, Santos, the other guys, they're really a threat to Brian Steil right now.
Yeah, no, I think that there's a reason why Donald Trump is going to be in western Wisconsin today and not southeastern. But we will have lots to talk about from that visit and many other things next week. Until then, I am Uneven Wagton Dog.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
See you next week.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
Rewind. Your Week in Review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.